Hi, my name is Steve Fleming, CEO of River City Bank, which was founded almost 50 years ago. As a leader in a family business myself and a longtime board member for the Capital Region Family Business Center, I understand firsthand how incredibly important family businesses are to our economy and the unique challenges they face in sustaining from generation to generation. I think that you will find this podcast series informative, entertaining, and even humorous at times. That's why our family business, River City Bank, is proud to support this podcast. I hope you enjoy today's episode.
So she found out that the family had started Frank Batch Restaurant. So when my dad took her to a family gathering, she wanted to bring something. So she decided to bring a pineapple upside down cake. And she told us that it was a complete failure and it was terrible. And at that point, she was so embarrassed because she's a lot of pride, right? And so she said that she's going to train herself to be the best cook in the family, not necessarily for the restaurant, but just in the family itself. And she did.
Hello, and welcome to A Seat at the Table, Trials and Triumphs of Family Business. Brought to you by the Capital Region Family Business Center, helping family businesses to grow and prosper. I'm Natalie Mariani Kling, your host and a fourth-generation family business member. I am so excited to join you around the table for real conversations about what it's like to grow up in, become a part of, and navigate the complexities of a family business. Special thanks to another family business, River City Bank, for their generous support of this program. On this episode, we speak with Kevin Fatt, third generation of Fatt Restaurant Group and Frank Fatt's Restaurant in Sacramento. We'll hear how a 16-year-old boy from China made his way into the restaurant business and created one of the oldest family-owned restaurants in Sacramento. We'll learn how this restaurant was connected to the heyday of California politics and how through hard work and a legacy of values, the Fatt family has become a pillar of the community and a quintessential American success story. Kevin, welcome to the studio.
Well, thank you, Natalie. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for being here. So I want to read something from your website,
okay,
and then I want to hear your thoughts about it. So it says, Frank Fatt's is more than a restaurant. It's a culinary institution, a pillar of the community, a quintessential American success story. What does that mean to you?
Well, when we first put that up, I was looking for something to capture just that. And it was actually with the help of our marketing manager who kind of put that together. And just to tell the story about how my grandfather became what he was been known for. And just so everybody can know that it took a lot of work. And it started off from a dream and some hard work and effort in order to get to where we are today. So just kind of wanted to capture that a little bit.
And I love what we've talked about too, but it's not just a restaurant. It meant something more to the community. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, yeah, my grandfather first started and, you know, he came here speaking little English at all. He eventually ended up understanding a lot more than he could speak, but he was knew enough to be able to build those relationships with some of his guests. And that's how he was able to build his reputation on is just, and his simple mantra was give them good food and give them a nice place and good service and they'll be happy. And that was pretty much stuck with us for a long time. And restaurant business is not that complicated. All the details are complicated, but as a whole, it's basically providing good food and good service.
And so Frank Fatt's is the oldest family-owned restaurant in Sacramento.
As far as we know, yes. Until I think it was last year or earlier this year, Club Pheasant was the oldest restaurant owned by the same family. But technically, since they're in West Sacramento, it wasn't in Sacramento. but they were a little older than us. So,
so you've been around for how long? How many years?
This will be our 84th year.
And your customers, you had a unique set of customers that made it the institution that it is in Sacramento. So tell us about that.
We did. We had a wide variety of customers from locals to, and since the in the proximity of the state capitol, a lot of the politicos from the capitol, the legislators or their staffers, lobbyists, and the surrounding businesses and residents in the downtown area. So it was a wide variety. And then plus families would come too from the different neighborhoods. So they'd come at for special occasions like anniversaries or birthdays. And then the politicos would come during the lunchtime and have meetings, discussions over food and drink. And back in the heyday, what they would say is that it didn't matter what side of the aisle they sat on, they'd have lunch over food and drink and hash it out and either compromise or agree to disagree, but they respected each other and they felt comfortable because my grandfather, it was important for him and his staff to make sure that his guests felt comfortable. And so he had instructed his staff that they're there to serve our guests, provide them a good environment, but you don't listen and you don't repeat. It's part of the reason why people felt comfortable going there and getting to know him better. So they trusted him.
He really created that environment and upheld it with his staff.
Yes.
Yeah. And so let's talk about your grandfather. So he came over to the U.S. from China.
Yes.
In 1919, he was 16 years old.
Right.
Which, can you just pause and tell us what we were saying yesterday about all the 16-year-olds we know? Can you imagine just that journey?
Yeah, a lot of the 16-year-olds I know, and just imagine if what they would do, just incredible. And I just think about, what did he do? You know, how did he do it? How did he communicate? He was looking for his dad. And his dad came over earlier after hearing about the Gold Mountain of the U.S.
And what's the Gold Mountain?
Well, the land of opportunity. And they obviously wanted a better life for their family or see if it was there. My grandfather, the family told him, you need to go get your dad. So, and he came over at 16 all by himself and came under a fake name at that time, but had some relatives that were there too, or relatives, I put in close quotes.
Why the fake name?
Well, his name wasn't fake, but his papers were under not his dad's name, but under some other relatives' names, I think.
Okay.
So I don't know why
something
his
about
dad,
being able to get into the country or something. Yeah.
So he had, was able to maneuver, and I don't know if he had a picture of his dad or some of his relatives, distant cousins had known about him, or maybe they knew what general area he was. And I didn't get that story of how he's able to reach him. And like we were talking about, I have a 16-year-old daughter, and I couldn't imagine her going through that. Even my son, who's 18 now, going to be 19, but if he was 16, there's no way he would have, I don't know how he would have survived, you know, without today's technology and things like that. Of course, back then is different and probably a lot more resourceful then, but because they had to be. I don't know how long it took him to find his dad. Probably, I would imagine, a pretty long time.
He finds his dad in the Midwest, and then his dad ends up going home, and his parents call him back for an arranged marriage.
That's correct.
And he goes dutifully.
Yes.
Right? How was that for him? Do you know what his experience was when he got home?
Yeah, he was not necessarily surprised, but I mean, I guess he knew it happened. And yes, as a dutiful son, he goes back and meets his bride-to-be. And so the story is that my grandmother told us, and told her daughters, you know, she wasn't too impressed by him when she first met him. It was weird. You know, we always had family gatherings every week. And so we would hear that story all the time and everybody would laugh. But yeah, she wasn't impressed because I think her side of the family was a little bit more from the upper crust village compared to my grandfather's village. And my grandfather's village is considered a farming village. But, you know, being the dutiful grandson he is, he married her and then a few years later, he decided to go back to the States and then maneuver his way through. He worked through in the jobs that he could work due to the Chinese Exclusion Acts back then. And so the various jobs that he could work in, like either laundry or canning or restaurants, that's what he did. And he would send money back to his family back in China.
Okay, so his wife stayed back.
Yes. She did get pregnant and they had their oldest son. And when he made enough money, he was able to send for them and have them come over here to the States. So my grandmother, when she came, she and her oldest son came through Angel Island.
Oh, wow.
And my grandfather had built his reputation and built some relationships where he was able to ask for assistance and having them, can they come a little bit earlier?
Wow.
So I think that's what I heard.
It's interesting. So many of your stories go back to your grandfather having this ability to create relationships and how that community ended up supporting him and his family in so many ways.
Yeah.
His friend shows him the restaurant business, right, at the time. Mm-hmm. And then he started to kind of get into it. And tell us how that progressed into him wanting to have his own restaurant.
He worked in the various restaurants, either as a cook, prep cook, dishwasher, busser, manager, supervisor. And he eventually enjoyed working in the business. And I think he enjoyed not necessarily working in the kitchen because he wasn't really a chef, or at least a trained chef. And he just knew what he knew. But I think he really liked being out on the floor and meeting these guests and getting to know them, even though he spoke very little English. So he had eventually came to Sacramento. And after venturing out in the Midwest and then in the Northwest and then Lake Tahoe a little bit, and then eventually settled in Sacramento and was working for a well-known restaurant called Hong King Lum on J Street. And that was one of the bigger Chinese restaurants in Sacramento area where a lot of the people would go for large banquets. And even all the politicos, local, state, went there to dine. And there was a basement down there. And from what I understand, there weren't any specifics and there weren't any pictures or or any journals. But from word of mouth, we heard there were gaming down in the basement. And one particular game, a Keno game, gentleman who I think was local, had a Keno ticket and talked to my grandfather and said, "Hey, I got to go. Can you hold on to my Keno ticket? And I'll come back to collect my winnings if I win." And sure enough, the ticket won. And again, no details, but it could be worth a couple $100 or a couple $1,000, which actually was a lot back then.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking about that too, it's like, well, they didn't have Venmo. They didn't have, right. They didn't have electronic payment. They didn't have credit cards. So I'm assuming it was all cash. So anybody could have walked away with it and nobody would have known. But my grandfather, when the gentleman came back, said, "Hey, Frank, did I win?" And my grandfather said, "Yeah, and here's all your winnings." And the gentleman said, you know, he appreciated his honesty and integrity and said, "Well, if there's anything I could do for you, just let me know. Give me a call and I'll see what I can do to help you out." And my grandfather, he did find a location in downtown where he wanted to open up his restaurant. And all his friends said, "No, you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't buy that location because it's not in a good area. And it's in the area where his restaurant is located right now on L Street." And around that area was considered Skid Row. And everybody thought he was crazy to buy that. But I think it was either maybe a combination of that's all he could afford and that maybe he had some inkling that it would be a good location because it's only a block and a half away from the state capitol. So I think he had kind of had an idea because of the people who he was serving over at Hong King Lum, mm-hmm. who he befriended too. So then when he was able to have a chance, I think he did call that gentleman and see if he could help. It's not clear on how he helped, if it was through financial or through his connections, that he was able to get the location. Prior to that was, and looking in the archives, Sacramento archives, it used to be an Italian restaurant and an Italian market. And then prior to that was, I guess, a speakeasy. And then prior to that was just an alleyway between two buildings. So
that's amazing.
Yeah.
And in the back of the building, talk about that. What was in the back?
So right next door to the building was a building that housed a auto dealership. It still exists. The building still exists. It's an office building now, but there's a half floor that currently exists, and that's where they used to store the cars. And in the back alleyway, which is a service alleyway, you could see the remnants of the lifts. And so they had car lifts that would lift the cars and they'd drive, just push it into that half floor.
Such cool history to be a part of and to be there surrounded by you all the time growing up. That's so cool. Yeah. So you grew up in the restaurant.
I did.
And did you always know you wanted to be a part of it?
No, actually, when I was growing up and I was working in, I started as a dishwasher like most of us did. I knew at that time, I said, I'm not going to work in the restaurant business ever again. So, but during high school and then in college, I'd come back to work during the summer worked my way up to prep cook, making pies and salads and things like that, and then doing busing and then hosting up until I left for college. And then decided at that time, I'm not coming back. So mm-hmm. like most Sacramento kids did, said that we're never coming back. Right. So
where'd you go to school?
I went to the University of San Francisco.
Okay.
So in San Francisco. So.
And what did you go to study?
I actually studied psychology, but with the emphasis in business management.
Wow. So, that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's so. Actually, we should all major in that.
it helps. Some of the things that do help. Yes.
Yeah, that's great. Okay. So you were on a path. You thought to yourself, I'm out.
Yeah.
I'm going to go study and then go do my own thing. And so what happens after college?
So I stayed in the Bay Area for a total of probably 16 years, 12 years in the city, and then 4 years down in the peninsula. Actually, my first job out of college was, believe it or not, still in hospitality as a hotel assistant manager at the Hyatt Regency in the Barcadero Center. And it was great.
Did that surprise you that you were in hospitality?
It did, actually. I was like, what am I doing? Yeah. So I thought I was going to get out of this. So, but I felt like at the time, that's what I knew. And that's what I felt comfortable with is guest service. And so I had that opportunity to do that. And it was a lot of fun. Learned a lot. It was on a grander scale. So it was interesting. So, and then it closed a year after I was there for a year to remodel. And so I decided to see what else is out there.
And where did you go from there?
I worked in various jobs, trying out different jobs, working in healthcare, working in marketing, working in the finance world, advertising world, just to try it out, see what it was like, see what those industries were like. Temp jobs. So I highly recommend it too if you don't know what you want to do. So
because you get exposure to all that, yeah.
Yeah, so I got a lot of exposure and learned a lot from different people. So, and then eventually, I worked in healthcare too for a while, and then got into manufacturing, candle manufacturing company, which was really interesting. And then eventually got into the tech world in the early 2000s or late 90s because I had a lot of friends who worked in there and said, oh, I want to try this out. And so asked, how do you think I can get in? And so I got in through a temp agency. And I said, I didn't care how or what position. I just wanted to get in and I'll move my way around and I'll figure it out. So I got an opportunity just to get in the door. Got into with the group that was growing. And it did grow. And it was emphasis at the time. Well, the company was Oracle in Redwood City.
Wow.
And got into a group where the effort was to put into front of the house software database. And at that time was called FOH.
So front of house meaning front of house for restaurants?
Not necessarily restaurants, for management.
Okay.
So almost like HR.
Okay.
Type stuff. So at that time it wasn't necessarily for restaurants, but for like hotels or something like that. So that division grew quite a bit. And the position I was, you know, wasn't really, I wanted to do something else. So I got introduced to the tech side, actually, in desktop support. Basic entry level there. And talked to the guys who were servicing my desktop and said, hey, how do I join you guys? And he said, oh, it's really easy. And it was. So, and it was a lot of fun. We had a lot of good times and a lot of good memories there. I enjoyed myself very much.
Wow. That's awesome.
Yeah.
And then what?
Then after that, then it was about 2003 when, unfortunately, the tech bust happened. And I had actually met my wife there during Y2K, actually. Mm. I was charged with installing our Y2K software on our division's desktops and happened to meet her there. And so in 2003, the tides turned and, unfortunately, they were letting people go. So I was one of the fortunate ones where they didn't let me go, but my wife was not. And it was hard for her to get back in either Oracle or any other company back then. And so she had my parents actually called her and asked her, hey, would you mind helping my dad out at his office? And my dad's a practicing dentist. And he had just a transition with an office manager leaving and he needed help. Even though in the background I was shaking my head, I was saying no. Because we loved our life. She's from San Francisco. So, but she said, I'll help out a couple of days a week. So she would go up there and stay there a couple of days a week. And sure enough, my mom and dad would try to influence her to move up to Sacramento. And so, you know, brilliant, of course. So they would wine and dine her and take her all the restaurants and all the shindigs so that my parents would go to. And so one day in 2000, I think it was early 2003 or late 2002, she calls me up and said, she's already talking about it. I said, I'm not ready. I like where we are. Mm-hmm. We had just got married in 2001 and we bought a home in Burlingame, and we had a great lifestyle. We had a lot of friends, and I can't speak highly enough about it, but then it came and she called me up and said, hey, you know, you should come up and take a look at this house that I just put a deposit on. I go, what?
Oh my gosh. Brilliant. Yeah. Did your parents have anything to do with that?
Maybe. Yeah, probably. So I think they would drive around all the neighborhoods. And actually in the long run, I kept on thinking that maybe I would return back to Sacramento. Because it's a great town to raise your family. Mm-hmm. I had a great childhood, no doubt about it, and very fortunate. So I eventually thought maybe when I do have a family, maybe raise my family up there. Mm-hmm. And so they could have the same style.
And to be clear, your mom is your grandfather's daughter.
Actually, my mom married into the family.
Oh, it's
my dad.
Your dad,
is,
okay.
So my grandparents had 6 children, 4 boys and 2 girls. And my dad is the 3rd oldest.
Okay.
So, yeah, he's in the
middle.
So
your dad decided to go become a dentist.
Yeah.
And your mom was doing what?
So my mom was a pharmacist.
Okay.
Trained pharmacist. So they met at University of California, San Francisco. She's from Hong Kong. She came when she was 17, 18 to a David Lipscomb College in Tennessee. I don't know how she ended up there or why she picked there, but she did.
What brochure landed in her little town?
I know. So she had, you know, decided to go into pharmacy school, and she got into UCSF at the time. And my dad, UCSF, also in dental school. And then they noticed each other across campus. And the story they told us that even though they noticed each other, then there's one day where they were walking in a stairwell and with a bunch of students. And then my dad comes up to her and says, hey, my name's Ken Fatt. What's yours? So we always tease him about that. But that's how they met. And they eventually started dating and then eventually got married. So
she has her career going. He has his career going. And then what happens where she starts to transition into your family business?
Yeah. So she found out that the family had started Frank Fatt's restaurant. So when my dad took her to a family gathering, she wanted to bring something. So she decided to bring a pineapple upside down cake. And she told us that it was a complete failure and it was terrible. And at that point, she was so embarrassed because she's a lot of pride, right? And so she said that she's going to train herself to be the best cook in the family, not necessarily for the restaurant, but just in the family itself. And she did. She studied cookbooks and watched cooking shows and just trained herself.
Do you remember this?
No.
Okay.
No.
So this was before you were born?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So then the family started talking about possibly opening up another restaurant in the early 70s. And again, they were already practicing there. She was working as a pharmacist and he was working in his dental office. And actually my mom was my dad's first office manager too. So, and then when they were talking about opening up a second restaurant, my uncle, my dad's younger brother, Tom, and his other younger brother, Jerry, who's the baby of the family, they were talking about Old Sacramento. The city wanted to redevelop Old Sacramento. And a lot of the longtime Sacramento families helped rebuild Old Sacramento. So happened to be a part of that. And so the family opened up a restaurant called China Camp in 1974. So my mom told my dad one night at home that I think I can help. My dad didn't want her to. So
why do you think?
I think it's because, you know, he kind of had an idea about the restaurant industry, how hard it would be. And not that she can do it, but I think they were just starting to have a family too. Mm. And my older brother was born already. And I was a young kid at the time. I was 7.
So Kevin, I want to ask you, so your dad at that time, he was what number child?
He was number 3.
Okay. So at that time, your older brother was the sort of expected one to take on the business. Is that accurate?
Yes. So like most Asian families, the oldest son would be expected to take over.
Okay. And so how was that for your dad? Do you think that he respected it and just took his own path? Or do you think that he had any resentment along the way? Or how was that for him?
I didn't hear of any story about him being resentful. But I do know, the only stories I do know is that my uncle and the rest of the family would say is when he and his younger brother, who was a year younger than him, Tom, would work in the restaurant, they weren't really working. So the older brother, I guess, had enough and said, "You're not coming back." So basically, they were fired from their own family's company.
That's so cute.
So, but I, you know, my grandfather, his goal was raising his family. They wanted to raise their family here and get them an education so they could find their own way. Yeah, the oldest son, that was his responsibility possibly to work for the restaurant. But I think that he didn't require the rest of the family to work in the business. And even the youngest son, my Uncle Jerry, who is our current president now, he even said that he was never pressured into working for the family business.
Okay, so back to your mom. So she says, "I think I can help." And your dad says, "Mm-mm."
Yeah. He didn't want her to, but, you know, my mom being my mom, she's stubborn and strong. And when she's committed, she's going, you know, 100%, 120% actually. And so she did it. And then when she told the family, the oldest son, my uncle, said, "Okay, you're in charge of the kitchen." And so she took it and ran with it. She created the menu and, well, of course, with the family, and hired all the staff and eventually ran the restaurant with my uncles. And then my oldest cousin, Wing's son, also worked in the restaurant too. And then in 1976, they decided to open up another restaurant right next door called Fat City Bar and Cafe. And my mom ran both of those with them.
Wow.
Shortly after that, they get a call from, I think, either mayor or Governor Pete Wilson. He said, "Hey, we've got a space in San Diego. You'd be interested in coming. We'd love to have you." And the space was, I guess, originally where the convention center was supposed to be built. So with that in mind, the family said, yeah. And so they took our Fat City Bar and Cafe and China Camp concepts down to San Diego. And my uncle, they found a building that was a previous supper club called Tops. Mm. And he loved the Art Deco design. It was perfect for him. And they decided to purchase that building and refurbish it. And so back in the day, it was a tower and they had neon lights, green or pink and blue. And you could see it as you're flying into the airport. And when you're about to land, you could see that tower.
Wow.
Every single time. But the tower's still there, but there's a hotel now. We opened those two restaurants in the late 70s, early 80s.
Wow. And so was your mom involved in opening those two?
My mom was partially involved. My Uncle Tommy, my Uncle Jerry, and my cousin Colin, who went down there and lived there and down there to run it. And my mom was still part of the developing the menu and helping with that part. So all the while, she's running the other two restaurants in Old Sacramento.
Right.
Yeah, as a general manager and executive chef. So.
And a mom.
And a
wife.
A mom, yes. And that's why we never saw her.
Amazing, yeah. Kevin, tell us about your mom's, she was a workhorse and a powerhouse in Sacramento. How did the community see her? How did she influence the community? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, my mom, after she started running the restaurants, then she took on a little bit bigger role because my grandfather was kind of had retired in the 60s from the day-to-day operations. And, of course, he was the face of the family for a long time. And the oldest son was a connection with Frank Fats. And then once we expanded to Fat City and China Camp, then that's when people were looking for somebody to represent the family. And my mom, I don't know if they said, "That's you," or if she just took it upon herself to do it. And I think she did. And she basically carried on the torch from my grandfather and my uncle. Wow. And because she understood the importance of it. You know, my uncle, her brother-in-law, who was, you know, also did that too, but he was in San Diego at the time. And so he was building his own reputation down there and relationships down in San Diego. So somebody in Sacramento had to do it. And, you know, my dad was busy with his dental practice. And I think that the family was comfortable with her doing it. And so how she did that was through basically, I think it started with, you know, doing the cooking shows on KCRA. It was on a weekly basis. And she would do the cooking shows and she became a familiar face in Sacramento. And so that's when I think she got involved with all the other organizations to help out with the California Restaurant Association Sacramento chapter, with the Downtown Sacramento Partnership, with helping starting the Old Sacramento Foundation and being part of the Old Sacramento Business Association, making those connections and working with other community leaders, even the city council and the mayors and city managers at the time, and helping guide where we want Sacramento to be or what we think Sacramento should be. So she was she took that on with no questions. I think she felt it was a responsibility. And my grandfather also felt it was responsible. We were responsible as business owners in Sacramento to also give back to the community. Yeah. And that was one way of doing it. And so my mom understood that and took that upon herself to take charge. And she did with 120%. Like I said, we never saw her when we were growing up. So it was hard for us. But as a working adult now, we totally understand. But, as a kid, we'd rarely see her. But she'd always try to, she'd come home and we'd have dinner sometimes. But she was always working late, long hours. My dad would go pick her up after his work. So that was our lifestyle.
So your dad was home more?
No, he was busy with his practice.
His own practice.
And then
yeah.
he would go to the restaurant and hang out there and then take her home. So,
and so how was the, were you guys, did you have other family that took care of you, or how did the,
no, not really.
No. You were on your own.
They had help at home. So, okay. And my brother is, he was older too. So he helped out too. So, but mostly babysitters or something like that. So we kind of fended on our own a little bit. So,
and did that influence how you wanted to parent?
A little bit. Yeah, actually. That was one of the reasons why, because I didn't see them that much, that was one of the reasons why I didn't want to join the family business. Because as I grew, eventually I knew I'd have a family, but I would want to have spend more time with my kids. So I knew in the restaurant business, it's tough to, especially during the holidays. So I made a commitment that when we would have our kids, that I would be a part of their lives. So, and I was fortunate enough to be able to do that, mostly because of the path that the previous generation paid for us. So
you found a way to be able to navigate that more.
Yes. But back, if we were just starting, then probably it wouldn't happen. But because they've paid the roads and we were established already, I could do that.
Yeah,
awesome. It was, again, like I said, very fortunate.
What does Fat Restaurant Group look like today?
Well, we are three restaurants with Frank Fats and two restaurants called Fats Asia Bistro and Dim Sum Bar in Folsom and Roseville. Roseville was built in 2000 and Folsom was built in 2004. So again, with families has built their reputation for all these years already. So they got an opportunity. They were asked, hey, would you be interested in opening up Roseville? And this is when Roseville was being developed. So we got a great opportunity and it was a fantastic opening. And in 2004, the same thing with Folsom.
And so what would you say your family values are that weave their way through those three restaurants? What makes them connected and unique to your family?
Probably just, what's important to us is not only our guests, but our employees, because we know it takes a big staff to run the restaurants. So without our employees, we probably couldn't do it. And I don't think it's unique to us, but we like to treat all our employees with fairness, dignity, and respect because we hold them very important and we value them. And so we want to not only train the technical aspect of it, but also we look for people who kind of have the service mentality, understand that we know that this is a service industry. Not only we take the order, but we also provide suggestions. We kind of guide our guests to, based on what we learn about them and to try to match what they are looking for.
The
best that we can, the best way that we can. This is kind of an art form. It's kind of going away a little bit with today's world, fast paced world. So, but that's still our values. It's still strong. And in order for us to get that, we need our employees to buy into that and understand that, why it's so important to us.
Yeah.
So is it easy? No. But it's a constant training and communication, and open communication is really important. And our values we developed those with the help of the Family Business Center. So in one,
Stella.
So the Family Business Center had a leadership program. for the next generation leadership. And myself and a few others, like our board chair, Maggie Bender, was in the same class. And we had an exercise of develop our values. And we didn't really have one at the time. And all of them, through brainstorming, they made a really nice suggestion. Actually, I think it was Maggie that said, why don't you use your last name? And we used our last name, F-A-T-S. And then we created our values out of that. So,
which are what?
Which are,
I know, I'm going to test you. I know. Anytime anyone asks me what our values are, there's five of them. Yeah. I get four. Yeah. I'm like, I know that. Wait, hold on. Give me a second.
I know. So it's family and food, attitude and atmosphere, teamwork and trust, service and safety.
Wow. Yeah. Well, that actually really embodies everything your grandfather created and stood for.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really cool. Yeah. So what's your role today?
You know, we're family business, and family business, we kind of usually just, everybody does whatever is needed to be done. Formality, my title is Chief Executive Officer, and my uncle is president still. And we're the only two of the family that are working in the business today, though. So I'm not sure what's going to happen with the next generation. I haven't received any word that anybody's interested at right now, but they're not all like myself. We're never said you have to work for the family business. So a lot of them are very successful professionals now. Mm-hmm. So, and the younger generation are getting there too, maybe a lot faster than me too.
I know. Well, that's kind of the fun part as a family business. If you're open to it, people tend to come back.
Yeah. Yeah. So my uncle, Jerry, he was in computer science at Berkeley, and I don't think he had planned on coming back. Mm-hmm. And actually my other uncle, Tom, was a practicing attorney, tax attorney, and I don't think he had any intentions on coming back. Mm-hmm. And my other cousin too was, I think, in physical therapy at UCLA. So I don't know if he ever intended on coming and working for the family, but we all did. So,
what do you think that draw is?
I was thinking about that too. So I think about that all too. Why did I come back? Because it's not an easy business, but I really enjoy the people who I work with. I enjoy the people who we meet, our guests, and just being able to get to know them and get to know what they do. I guess our family is really interested in people. And like my grandfather was, I've always enjoyed meeting new people. I always was fascinated in hearing other people's stories, how they became who they are and what they do and why. And I think that always has been a part of me, where that part in interacting with people was the fun part. So
how is it when you are on the floor today at Frank Fats? Do you still have that experience?
Yeah, I do. So I love meeting new guests come for the very first time. And I always ask where they're from and ask them, you know, how did they come about finding us? And then, you know, try to share, hey, you'll have to try our famous banana cream pie. Or believe it or not, we're also known for our Frank style New York steak or our Mai Tai. So introducing him to our food, and that was the one thing that my grandfather wanted, and why he started the restaurant also, is because not only of the restaurant industry that he loved, but wanted to share his culture too through food. And so he was able to do that, and that has been instilled in us to be proud of our heritage and our culture and share it. Mm-hmm. So
tell me about, from a family perspective, what are some of the more challenging things you've had to face and overcome as a family?
Probably the first one was hiring the first non-family member into the business in a key position. That was always a challenge. And I think a lot of other family businesses have the same experience, because it's that, the whole trust thing. You know, we're bringing in somebody new who's not even part of the family. They don't know what the family's about and why we started it. And that was probably one of the hardest experiences. Our first non-family member in the critical role was probably in our controller position. So, which is a big position, right? They're supposed to manage our money.
Yeah.
So we've always had a family member doing it. And that was probably a tough part. So we did eventually go through it. And then, because we've had non-family members in the manager position at the restaurant. So, but there was always a family member involved with the restaurant. So. Sure. But probably that first one was the controller position. And then eventually...
And how did that go for the family?
Well, we hired a consultant to help get us through that and look for, and search for somebody. So And that was in 2004, about 2004, because I came back in 2003. So I remember going through that process of searching.
I mean, that's pretty amazing to contemplate. You were around for 60 years before you had to hire a significant outside person.
Right.
It's amazing.
Yeah. When you think about it that way. Yeah. So I know it was a lot on the family's minds about, you know, is this the right way? Is this the right direction?
And then when you brought someone in, did you have those open conversations or did you all just kind of cross your fingers and go, here we go?
Well, you know, at that time I was managing the restaurant, so I wasn't necessarily seeing that, but I think it was more of a cross our fingers and we'll see. So. Yeah. But nowadays, when we bring people in, I like to meet in higher positions. I like to meet with them and spend a day at our corporate office. So they meet with our HR manager. They meet with our marketing manager. They meet with our accounting department. They meet Michael Jerry. And then I meet with them. And this includes managers, any restaurant managers. And I will take them to Frank Fats, our flagship, and sit down with them and chat with them and over lunch and just share with them how we got here. Why we do what we do, and what's important to us. And so they can get to know the family philosophy a little bit so they can understand why some of the decisions that we make are because it could be, even the restaurant business is not difficult and most restaurants do the same thing. Everybody has their own unique style. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of non-family members who work for us now and they bring in those different styles, different knowledge experiences from different restaurants. And so it's important for me and for the family to share why we do things so they can understand why we've been around for 84 years.
Yeah.
And what's important to us.
Yeah, that's huge. Yeah. Do you find that what are people's typical reaction to that? Do you find that people lean into that?
Yeah, I think so. They enjoyed it. They told me they love hearing the stories. And yeah, I haven't gotten any bad feedback yet. Yeah. So.
I mean,
I'm always curious, you know, what do you think? You know, so.
Well, because you're creating that connection right up front, which I would imagine is pretty big. And then people coming in and already feeling a sense of loyalty or engagement.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
That's really cool. Right. Any other trials or tribulations that you've gone through that you feel is important in your history or that would be helpful for other family businesses?
I think we were talking a little bit about, you know, the times in the 60s where we had a fire and we had to rebuild. And then in the 80s when we remodeled and had a grand party. And the 80s were really the heyday and even the 60s and part of the 70s. And then it was the 90s that were doing pretty well, but Sacramento was expanding then. And then, you know, of course, we were expanding as well. And actually, one of the reasons why I came back, when I was thinking about it, they did say, well, if you're going to come back, then it's a good time to come back now. Because they had a few non-family members as general managers of Frank Fats Restaurant, our flagship. And the last one, it didn't go so well. So they were hoping to get back a family member. And there was no takers until this sucker. No, I'm kidding. There's a P.T. Barnum says there's a sucker born every minute, right? No, I'm kidding. No, so that was an opportunity that came about. And of course, they left it up to me to decide. There's no pressure at all. And I just said, I could do this. So, of course, I had to learn a lot right as soon as I got there. But it wasn't as rocky as it probably could have been. And unfortunately, my first week, I had to terminate multiple people. So, because they just, apparently they just weren't the right fit.
And did you see that or had people been seeing that?
The assistant managers had seen it and provided the recommendations but I had to make my own decision. And so I would meet with them regularly. And
that's a tough way to
enter. It was a challenge. That was hard because ultimately I like people, you know, so it was hard. So.
Well, and entering in as a family member and the lovely person that you are to come in and know that other people were going to see you as one of your first actions was to terminate. That must have had to wrestle with that a little bit.
Yeah. I actually lost a lot of weight for the first few years.
I can imagine.
It was very stressful.
Yeah.
That part was the most stressful, more so than dealing with customers. Mm-hmm. So I guess.
You mentioned the heyday. Tell us about how the heyday of the restaurant kind of coincided with the heyday of California politics.
So Frank Fast is only a block and a half away from the state capitol. As I mentioned, my grandfather built his reputation and his relationships through these individuals who worked at the capitol, and they would come and dine at the restaurant. And a lot of them would go through the back door in the kitchen. And so they would dine there during lunch and or have a cocktail or something like that. And in the front of the restaurant is about 9 banquette tables. And then in the corner booth, as they call the corner booth, or what they also nickname is the power booth. And all the politicos around there would say, you're somebody if you're sitting at that corner booth. So all the power brokers, like Willie Brown, like all the governors, like a lot of other well-known lobbyists, would sit there. And the secondary one was table 9 right next to it. That would be the secondary power booth. Mm. And power booth meaning that they sat there to be seen. Mm. And they, when they wanted to be seen, they would say they want to sit out front. And then, but if they wanted some privacy, they would sit in the back booths, which we have about 7 of them. And that's when we had, up until the 80s, we had curtains, beaded curtains there. And so they had some semi-privacy there. Funny, because actually, I remember Willie Brown would tell this story. He would say when he would come in, he would point at certain people and they call them pigeons. And they were all at the bar or at the banquet and said, that's my pigeon. So basically, they would be paying for his meal.
Oh, how so, funny.
So it was a great, it was a hilarious story. Another funny story that actually Governor Brown, Jerry Brown, told us fairly recently on his second stint as governor, is that he'd come in, and I think all the governors have at least dined at the restaurant at least once as governor, probably more as a legislator or other positions other than governor, but probably Jerry Brown is, I think, one who's dined the most, and he has a couple of favorite seats, and this time around he came in. And my uncle at the time, or we call him Uncle Kai, everybody else calls him Wing. And so he said, and my uncle had already built these relationships, continued on building the relationship as my grandfather did, because he, you know, was able to communicate well, and he was a graduate of Sac State. And so he had a friendship with the governor, and the governor comes in and says, hey, Wing, how you doing? That's how casual it was. And my uncle said, hey, Governor, how are you doing? And so Governor sits down, sits at the power booth. My uncle says, hey, what's going on today? Yeah, well, Wing, I'm just coming here for lunch, and I'm going to want to sit down. And my uncle says, and this is what Governor Brown's telling me. Your uncle says, well, I'm glad that you're here, Governor, but I can't have you sit here. Governor Brown says, well, Wing, don't you know who I am? And he says, of course I do, Governor. But you're going to be governor over there. You could be governor over there. You could be governor over here. I just can't have you governor over here. So, and he told us that. So we were just, it was such a great story.
The fact that he could tell, the governor could tell you that story.
I know.
Is a real, shows how their relationship was so strong.
Absolutely. And same with Willie Brown. I mean, there's some stories that they didn't tell us, but a lot of people didn't tell us, but there's some really funny stories. And they were all part of it, too. And even all the lobbyists that were there, we have a longtime lobbyist and friend who's become a friend of the family for years, George Steffes. And he's kind of a staple now, too. And he and his friends would come in and sit at the end of the bar, and everybody would see him. They would know who he is. And that's what it was back then. They're in the heyday, too. Everybody would know each other, say hi. It was like Cheers. And that's how it was. And it's still kind of that way. A lot of the newer generation now, the younger generation, when the previous generation would bring them in, they're carrying on that tradition too.
Oh, wow. So, how cool.
Yeah. So it's really neat to see. And we actually just reopened for lunch and they started coming back.
So. Kevin, last question we ask all of our guests. Do you think that the success of Fat Restaurant Group is more due to hard work or luck?
A little bit of both, but mostly hard work, but a little bit of luck as well. So you got to have luck. There's always going to be luck involved, but it's what you do with it, though. They got the luck, but then they worked their butts off to get to where we are.
Yeah.
And we still are.
Yeah.
So
thank you so much.
Oh, you're
what
welcome.
An awesome story.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to A Seat at the Table, Trials and Triumphs of Family Business. If you like what you heard today, please be sure to subscribe, post a positive review, and share with another family business owner. For more information about the Capital Region Family Business Center, visit capfamilybus.org. That's capfamilybus.org. You can also follow us on Facebook at Capital Region Family Business Center and on Instagram at CapFamBiz, B-I-Z. If you know of other family businesses that have a story to share, please contact Stella Primo, show producer and executive director at S Primo, P-R-E-M-O, at capfamilybus.org. We're grateful for the support of River City Bank to make this program possible. And special thanks to Guy Raz from How I Built This for a wonderful closing question that's become one of our favorites.
Hi, this is Steve Fleming of River City Bank, and we're proud to bring you the Capital Region Family Business Center podcast series.